Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the YPT podcast series. Really excited to be back and recording another episode. This time, we're going to be talking about career in transplant surgery and what you know, why to select the field of transplant surgery. What's exciting about it? What are the pros and cons about it? If you're a woman in transplant surgery, what are the particular challenges to you and how to overcome those? How to get that key balance of work life in a long career and in a challenging career. And I'm really excited to have a leader in the field of transplant surgery to talk to us today. We approached Ikita a few months ago, and they've very keenly suggested Professor Lorna Marson to come and talk to us about it. Many of you would know her and would have heard her speak about this subject before. So she doesn't need much introduction, but Professor Lorna Marson is a professor of transplant surgery at the Royal Infirmary of Edinburgh in Scotland. She works clinically as a kidney and pancreas transplant surgeon. Having completed her clinical training in Edinburgh, she was awarded a Clinical Scientist Award from the Academy of Medical Sciences, which allowed her to take up the post of clinical academic within the University of Edinburgh. And Lorna continues to have an interest in clinically relevant research in renal transplantation, has had a number of grants and numerous publications, and supervised many PhD and MD students. She now chairs the UK Organ Donation and Transplant Research Network. She was also the first woman president of the British Transplant Society from 2017 to 2019. And chaired the College of European National Transplant Societies until September 2021. She's had a significant role in the delivery of undergraduate and postgraduate medical education in Scotland, having been Transplant Programme Director and Associate Dean in the southeast of Scotland. I hope I've covered everything there. Welcome to the podcast, Professor Marson. Thank you for your time again.
Thank you very much, Dylan. Great to be here, and thank you for your very kind introduction.
Thank you very much. I'm sure there's a whole lot of things I've missed out, but let's get into it. So I've given a little bit of background, but perhaps you could tell us in your own words a little bit about yourself, where you're from, where you did your training, and what you're doing now.
Sure, thanks very much indeed. So my parents are both from the west coast of Scotland, but they raised me in London. My father was a GP in a tough area in South London, and that is where I was brought up. I trained my undergraduate training was also in London. I trained at St Thomas's Hospital when it was a standalone medical school, which shows my age a little bit. And I did my basic surgical training also in London, based on a rotation from Barts Hospital. I then moved to Scotland to join the Southeast Scotland Registrar rotation, and that's really where I undertook my higher surgical training. I loved surgery from an undergraduate. It was always that they were always the placements that I enjoyed the most. And although there were plenty of people who tried to put me off surgery, saying that it was impossible as a woman, and particularly as a woman who was considering at some stage to have a family, those people that know me, I think, would probably use the word stubborn. I would prefer the word determined, but anyway, both of those probably apply. So if I'm told I can't do something, then I'm likely to pursue it with much more alacrity. So higher surgical training in Southeast Scotland, planning on doing breast surgery as a career, undertook my postgraduate research. I did an MD in breast cancer, and was all set for a career in breast surgery. I had two children at that time on either side of my research. And so a career in breast surgery, with its daytime working and relatively elective working, seemed a very sensible option. And then as part of my training, I came to the transplant unit in Edinburgh, and I ostensibly to undertake training in endocrine surgery. But in order to gain that experience, I had to get involved in transplantation. And I found it a very compelling place to be. I think one of the really things that struck me first was the team, the team working, the team ethos. And it was a really multidisciplinary team. So you're working with senior nurses who are the transplant coordinators. You're working with a wide range of physicians and surgeons. And so that real team ethos was what attracted me, as well as the really exciting technical challenges of the surgery, the immunology. I've done work more around angiogenesis in breast cancer, and I could see how that interaction between the innate immune system and the adaptive immune system would be of real interest. And also the ethical challenges that is the kind of bread and butter of what we do. But obviously, changing from breast surgery to transplant surgery with two children under the age of five was not a sensible, what could not be in any way defined as a sensible option. But I really felt that unless I tried, I wouldn't know if I could do it. And so at that stage, I reduced my working hours. So I started to work 60% of full time, and I half the amount of emergency surgery cover that I did. So I really properly became, if you like, less than full time. And that is how I completed my training, which allowed me to spend some time with the family whilst also pursuing the dream that had become transplant surgery.
That's great, Lorna. We'll touch about onto some of those particular topics that you've been through. Thank you for that that summary. I've also trained in St. Thomas's and Royal London, so I'm honored to follow in your footsteps. If we can go back again to your medical student days and your early training, was surgery something you wanted to do from the very beginning at medical school level, or is that something that sort of came a bit later on?
So when I went to medical school, it certainly wasn't something that I was thinking about. I think I had pediatrics in my head when I joined the medical school. But when I started my clinical placements in third year, my first placement was with the professorial surgical unit with some pretty big names. Professor Kevin Bonand, Professor Norman Browse were the two professors of surgery there. And I was responsible for coordinating that 8 week block, which was pretty terrifying, I have to say. But I just really enjoyed the, again, it was the team working. It was a real, so purposeful and inspired by those individuals and also the registrars and more junior doctors. And I was given an opportunity very early on to go to theatre. It was expected that you would see patients from the time of their admission through theatre and out, even whatever day of the week or hour of the day that was. But it meant you felt part of the team. And that really continued in my undergraduate training. It was the surgical specialties that really inspired me, orthopedics, the general surgery particularly. And I enjoyed the medical placements, but just not as much. But as I said, the issue was that people around me were just saying, don't, you'd be insane if you went down that road. There were very few women. There was a female senior registrar on the surgical unit. But apart from that, there were no other women in sight. So when I graduated, I decided either to do obstetrics and gynecology or surgery. And then it was about which job was offered to me first. And I got an A&E job based at St. Thomas's with the demonstrating other half. And that really led me down the road of doing my primary surgical exams. And then again, I thought about orthopedics. But again, the paths diverged, and I went to Chase Farm Hospital as part of the Barts rotation, which is a busy district general hospital. And I worked for an upper GI surgeon and was totally inspired by his lovely attitude with his patients, his ability to communicate with his team, as well as being a really good technical surgeon. And again, for me, it was really being part of a small team that inspired and encouraged me to think about therefore general surgery at that stage.
Yeah, interesting. You say Professor Bernand was, I did my first house officer job in 2007 under Professor Kevin Bernand, so I know exactly how terrifying
I
that
was his house officer in
things
1990 then. That was my
are.
first house job. Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting what you say. It's quite common, really, that balance between people putting you off and people inspiring you. And for most of us, hopefully, the number of people inspiring you outweighs the number of people putting you off. And the key elements that you touched on there was that team ethos and being part of a team and belonging. I think is really important, isn't it? And that's what draws us into surgery, as well as, exposure to operations at an early stage and getting that satisfaction of doing an operation, sort of, in inverted commas, fixing something that often inspires a lot of us. And you've got to have a good dose of that early in your career to get inspired to go into surgery, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I can still remember when I did my orthopedic house job, which was the other half of the job with KGB. I did a hemiarthroplasty. I remember it. I can remember the patient. I can remember his name. And I was taken through a hemiarthroplasty by the consultant. Now, of course, some of that was clearly I was very enthusiastic, went to theatres a lot. But also for that consultant to put that degree of actually what you realize with time, it's that degree of trust in his own ability, so that he knew that he could support me to do that operation and that he could manage the consequences or take me through it safely as essentially a junior house officer. So yes, I there are certain times that you pinpoint and you can remember very clearly, which had a massive influence. And I suppose what I really find fascinating is that these people don't realize the impact that they had on you. And in actual fact, I recently, in the last year, had lunch with that orthopedic surgeon. I haven't seen him for 30 years, and out of the blue, he contacted me and we had lunch. And so, in a way, the privilege of them being able to say to him, look, you played a massive role in my decision to go into surgery, and thank you for that. And I suppose that's the other side of what I think about quite a lot is remember to thank these people years down the line, because they, there are so many paths that diverge, and somebody helping you through an operation or through a difficult situation, whatever it might be, they're the people that forge your career for you ultimately.
Yeah, absolutely. And like most of us, we go through different jobs, don't we, in our training. And I think in many European centers, you're probably more in one unit than we are in the UK. I think in the UK we go through a lot more rotations, but all of us to some extent kind of rotate between departments. And inevitably you'll go into a department where you don't really enjoy it. The people aren't as nice to you. And hopefully that will be a short-lived kind of rotation. But how do you get through that? How do you get through rotations where you're not really enjoying yourself, where you're questioning your decision about whether this is the right speciality for me? How do you get through those difficult periods? I can certainly remember in my own training having a few 6 month jobs where I questioned whether this is the right thing for me, but just got through it. How did you must have had the same. How did you get through that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's a huge challenge. And I think one of the years that I remember were, as being particularly difficult was also a year when I was training less than full time. And whilst I don't want to kind of mix the two challenges, that both of those bring significant challenges. I think there are a few things here, aren't there? If I think you learn as much from people who don't treat you the way you would like to be treated as those that do. It's very hard during it, but I think in retrospect, those times are probably times of greater learning than when you're working in a fantastic team where everything works, because you do undoubtedly absorb behaviors that you do not want to display, and you can make a very positive decision not to treat people the way you've been treated. I think the other thing is, I think what kept me going during that time is if you're doing surgical placements, you're still getting tech, you're getting operative experience. And even if that isn't the way you'd like to get it, and I think, sometimes those bad experiences because you're not actually allowed to do anything, or but actually just remembering that every time you're in theatre, you're learning something, even if you're not quite learning what you'd like to be learning. I suppose it also, again, in retrospect, teaches you a lot of about your determination and your resilience, your grit, that determination to keep going. And there are some people who decide that surgery isn't for them after such an experience, and that's okay too. But if you get through it and absorb the lessons that you need to learn from that, then those experiences are incredibly beneficial. I think the difficulty that that comes is if those are your most common experiences and just, placement after placement, or if you're in a, as you say, in a European training system where perhaps you don't get the opportunity to move on, then that's a real challenge. That's a real challenge. And how you deal with that and have some of those difficult conversations with people who are much more senior to you is a whole different level of discussion, I think.
Yeah, absolutely, and we'll come on to talking about mentorships and things a bit later on. But as you say, all of us do go through difficult periods in our training, whether it be lack of surgical exposure, difficult team members, difficulties at home and family and so forth. But it's hopefully you've got enough of the support and enough, and you. As you say, you tend to learn a lot more from the bad experiences, and you learn not to what not to emulate in your future career. So I wanted to just move on to your selection of transplant surgery. So you've from your initial summary, you've sort of approached transplant surgery in a quite a convoluted way, and it certainly doesn't sound like it was what you wanted to do at the beginning, and it sounded like you fell into it rather than that's what you wanted to do. You sounded like you were going down the breast and endocrine route for a long time before you ended up in transplant surgery, and that's okay, and that's fine. I think for most people, transplant surgery is difficult to get into, partly because not many units in the in your particular country do transplant surgery, so you don't get that exposure, whereas breast, colorectal and upper GI are far more common. So tell us a little bit about what inspired you into transplant surgery in particular after being a breast surgeon for so long.
Yeah, so I think I had never seen anything about transplantation before, and you're right, transplant teams and transplant units are often part of big teaching hospitals, and so they seem very distant, very kind of unapproachable, really. And I guess that's something that really interests me now, is making sure that our medical students and our junior surgeons get some kind of flavor of this, because it's really difficult. I was fortunate in the sense that I was quite a senior trainee when I decided to switch to transplantation, and it was at a time when there weren't enough transplant trainees, and so I was able to take that sideways move without it being a major problem. It was when there was a kind of a national shortage of transplant trainees and therefore transplant surgeons. But as I said to you, and I think I'd been having a few doubts about breast surgery, in terms of the technical aspects. And I know that in many ways it has moved on, and there are many more reconstructive components. But I mean, we did lat dorsi flaps, and they were beginning to do some tram flaps. But I think I was not feeling terribly inspired by the technical aspects. I felt as if the organization of the sort of multidisciplinary team, the whole team approach, was well established. And as I say, I had done some research in that area, which really interested me. But I didn't feel as inspired. okay, which I was big, so I was beginning to question it a little bit, and then, as I say, I went to join the transplant team here, and I suppose it's again, it's coming back to it's the team. I really enjoyed the joint ward rounds with physicians and surgeons, with the coordinators there, the theatre staff. I think going out on retrieval as a trainee is a massively bonding experience with your theatre team. So you get really close to your theatre team, which becomes very important when you're doing those very technically difficult operations in hospitals that you've never worked in before. And then bringing the organs back and transplanting them. So I think there was that extraordinary team ethos. But also, I hadn't planned on being an academic. I was an NHS trainee, and I'd always been pretty dismissive of having to do research, but I had to do it. But after finishing my MD and then beginning to see how that interest could translate across into transplantation, I just began to just feel really excited by it. And then you put in the ethical challenges around living donation and the discussions that are both the living donor kidney MDT and also the liver MDT, the listing MDT for liver transplant. Like, wow, this is absolutely fascinating. And so I spent another year, just under a year elsewhere, training in colorectal surgery, just thinking, what do I do? What do I do? Do I stay with breasts? Do I, you know, and then at the end of that, I approached the TPD at that time and said, look, I really just want to give this a go. I really want to be a transplant surgeon.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? I think I was similar to you. I was inspired by the multidisciplinary nature of decision-making, even in transplant surgery, just even, you know, simple things as doing joint ward rounds with the nephrologists or hepatologists. That sort of thing is quite unique to transplant surgery. It doesn't really exist in other surgical specialties as much. And that in itself is quite inspiring. And we haven't even touched on the surgical aspects and how brilliant it is to see a, you know, a liver or a kidney pink up and a patient do well. So yeah, I totally understand where, you know, where you come from, in terms of your love of transplant surgery. So wanted to go on to talking a little bit about research and sort of nail down on and some of the opinions you had about research. And having done research, having supervised research students yourself, what is your current opinion on the importance of a higher degree, and whether it be an MD or a PhD, you know, when you're going into or looking into a career in transplant surgery? How important is it? When is the best time to do it?
I think it really does add value to your training. And as I've alluded to, I was pretty reluctant to come take time out of program. I was just really keen to be a really good clinical surgeon. But in Southeast Scotland at that time, all the surgical trainees on the program, apart from me, had a higher degree or were out of program taking a higher degree. So it's made very clear to me that was going to happen. And actually, I really valued that time out. It gives you time to do something very different, to work with different people, so to work with basic scientists, to work with research nurses, and just to learn a whole different set of skills around literature review, around management of data. And of course, now there are many more courses for each of those things which really add value to that. I think it's tough. I think it's hard, and I think particularly for surgeons, you know, those of us, we're very accustomed to having our day allocated to us. We don't have to think a huge amount about what to do. Whereas in research, you've got a day stretching out ahead of you where you've got to decide what you're going to do. And you do experiments for weeks that then don't work. So I think it's really challenging. I think those lessons are very valuable. I think in transplantation, it is important to do research. It is important to, even if it's to give presentations, to even its poster presentations, to or oral presentations at national and international meetings. And I think the BTS is a really good forum for that, and of course ESOT as well. So I think it by doing research, you open the doors of opportunities to network both nationally and internationally to present your work. And I think that opens you to the community, which again is a wonderful community to be part of. And so I think that both aspects are very important. Now, whether the research has to be basic science, I think that gone are the days where everyone has got to go into the lab. And I think that's good because actually sending a surgeon into a lab for a short period of time is not the best use of laboratory time and space or that surgeon's time necessarily. So for some people, that will be the right way to go. For others, it may be a more clinically based and increasingly, systematic reviews. These really add value to our understanding of aspects of transplantation. And also, I think around surgical education, some of the broader topics, surgical education or the non-technical skills, understanding more about the contribution of human factors, these are all research areas that are of interest and are of relevance. So I think it's about. I think research is important, but I think we can really broaden our concept of what that means so that people can find an area that is of particular interest to them. And then thereafter, postdoctorally, I think that's when it becomes much more a kind of individual choice. And the number of individuals that remain in research, a significant part of their work, let's say, drop off. But I think that's right as well. So I think, I think the I think if I think that balance is struck, and I think it is difficult to carry on in lab-based research in the postdoctoral time because that's really when you're trying to get your surgical tr technical training optimized. So I think it does add value. It gives you the skills that you then need to take forward as you continue in clinical research or understanding of the literature to assess the literature. So I think yes, I think it adds value, and it's part. It, particularly in transplant, which remains actually very driven by research, and there are changes that are taking place because of research that's relatively recently been in the lab. I think an understanding of that is key.
As you said, it's worthwhile time, really, isn't it, to get to know the community, to present, to build sort of non-technical skills, to even mature yourself as a surgeon and as a clinician. I noticed that you did your research in breast surgery. So does that matter that you've done your research in an unrelated field when you're looking to go ahead in your career? Did it impact you? Does it matter? I mean, I'm sure there's a number of trainees coming through who've done research in other fields and now thinking of transplant surgery. How does that impact things, or does it not really matter too much?
So I think for me, I look back and I guess I'm sorry that I wasn't part of the community sooner. But has it had a negative impact? Except that I think I've missed out. No, I don't think it has. And I suppose the evidence is that I did get the Clinician Scientist Award, which was on transplant-based research. And I did become president of the British Transplantation Society. So that if I missed out on the early years, then it hasn't served me badly.
You
I
certainly
think
did,
when it
right?
when I got the Clinician Scientist Award, I think again, you see, I would come back to it's about the people because I was given two bits of advice by John Saville, who was the head of the medical school here, who's obviously chair of the MRC for a while. And he said, go and speak to Jeremy Hughes and go and learn this technical skill. And it's the people you work with and the people that's what got me the Clinician Scientist Award. It's that group of people you work with. You do it in isolation, you won't do anything, but you've got to be collaborative and as part of a community. So I don't think I was disadvantaged. And actually, a lot of the skills I took into transplant.
Yeah, it's all transferable skills, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
And
Yeah.
just sticking to the research theme, so one last question on that is, having done your training and having done your research, that you then went on to build your own research portfolio and supervise research students. So What advice have you got for new consultants who've recently been appointed, looking to build their own research portfolio, looking to start clinical trials at an early stage in their consultant career? What sort of how, you know, you touched a little bit upon the importance of having a good team around you, but what are the other sort of things that you need to consider?
So I think you have to be realistic about what you can achieve in the time that you have available to you. And I think if you're working as an NHS consultant, then seeking there are certain research awards where you can get funding for two of your PAs or have many for research. I think we all, particularly maybe surgeons, do believe that we can do everything. And that we can take on running big clinical trials as well as doing all of our clinical work and not burning out. And I think the reality is we can't, we have to look at the time that we have available to us, and we have to say, if I take on research or if I recruit to a clinical trial or if I run a clinical trial, then that will take up a certain amount of my time, particularly running a clinical trial, getting a clinical trial set up. And running it is a massive amount of work. And I seriously underestimated how much time that would take. And I think even being a collaborator on a trial, so a local PI, takes up more time. You know, when you sign saying, yes, I'm really interested on the grant application, you don't actually think about what time that's going to take. And I think we are totally unrealistic about what we can achieve. And we have to be more realistic about what we can do in the time that we have available. And I've always believed that fundamentally, you have to be a good clinician, you have to be an excellent surgeon. And your research is important, but if it jeopardizes your clinical practice in any way, then you really have to regroup. And I think that for me has always been a almost like a touchstone. It's like I've got to be able to do my clinical job well, and being realistic about your time, getting good people around you, get taking on good students if that's what you're going to do through whatever level they are, offering them the support early, particularly early in the project that they need, and then allowing them to run with it themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. That's great advice. So I think it always comes back to your how good you are as a clinician, isn't it? That's your sort of you know, that's your cornerstone. No matter how many grant rejections you get, publication rejections you get, you can always go back to being a good clinician and then start again. And how important is it to have an ally as a you know, in your research, either clinically or in the lab, did you go and seek out collaborations within, say, for example, the University of Edinburgh and set up, you know, be a co-supervisor with people rather than to taking it on yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you need allies both clinically and in the research area. You need them everywhere. And I worked with Jeremy Hughes for a long time, who's an academic nephrologist, and he's a macrophage. So I work in the Centre for Information Research, which is there's a lot about macrophages in there. So in a sense, that worked for me. I was interested in this new blood vessel formation, which happened. And it was related to innate immunity, so macrophages and angiogenesis linked well. And I brought that into transplantation from the work I'd done in breast cancer, and worked with Jeremy and then David Cluth, and still I work with those guys. I don't work so much in the research area with them, but we're both very involved. We're all very involved in undergraduate medicine, so they've been my partners in my university role for more than 20 years. And so to have those allies is collaborators, friends, really is so valuable. And I think I only really appreciated it when I did worked with another collaborator in the university who then entered into a really, ridiculous sort of fight over who was going to get the senior authorship on the paper. And it made me realize how fantastic these guys are that I've worked with over a long period of time, because there's never any of that. It's very it, we yeah we've never had any kind of bickering or disagreements about that, and it made me really value that. They are in it for the research and for the team and not for their own self-aggrandissement, which I think a lot of people sadly still are. And similarly, you need allies in the clinical space, because if you're an academic, you're not there, you're not working clinically all the time. And there are some of your colleagues who believe that you should be, or believe that if you're not in the hospital, then you're home with your feet up. So you need to establish that support network on in all areas. And of course, you need to do the same at home when you're raising a family as well. You need to know that somebody's going to pick up your children, even if it's not going to be you. So have it, building up that team around you, that family around you, is essential and remains essential. And I suppose what I like now is that, in a sense, I can support other people, both in the clinical area and in the academic area, in the way that I was supported.
Yeah, there's it's always important to remember there's enough research to go around for everyone to be senior author at some stage, isn't there?
Yeah, I that would be my take on that. Yes, absolutely.
There's plenty of research, and and things always come around. So we've talked quite a little bit about research. What I wanted to move on to is something you just touched on at the very end there, around work-life balance, and you've clearly, had a very successful career, but done a lot. And so, if you could talk us through some of the aspects of work-life balance which, people struggle with, and I think something that I still constantly hear from more junior colleagues coming through the ranks is that, oh, I don't really want to go into transplant surgery because there's too much nighttime work, there's too much, it's a difficult career, far more than colorectal or upper GI. So there's this, in my opinion, an ongoing myth about transplant surgery, that it's so much more hard work than any other surgical specialty, and so much more, difficult on your life. Is that true? How did you manage your work-life balance through your career? Talk us through a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. So it's challenging. There's no doubt it's challenging. I don't know that it is any harder than any of these other surgical specialties, but I suppose, again, it's about, if you love something, then it doesn't feel quite as hard, I don't think. During my training, I was on retrieval and implant rotors, so at, joint, as it were. So at times I was pretty hammered, as we all are. And when my children were quite small. So it is difficult. I did work, as I say, 60%. So I worked for a while. I worked 3 days a week, and then and half time on call. I tended to work an extra day, did research in an extra day, but that was my own choice, to be honest. And so I did have that flexibility. And we have quite a cadre of women who are going through that now in Edinburgh. We've got two of our transplant trainees who've just come back from mat leave, and it's difficult, and I watch them, and it's difficult, and there's no getting around that. But having a baby of one who's up a lot is difficult, whatever you do during the day, I think, really. And the other challenge that you have is, if you've taken time out, either for research or for mat leave, then you have to come back, and obviously you're not as good as you were when you left. And so there's that degree of acceptance that you're going to take a little bit of a time to get back up to speed. So all of these things are challenging. So I think the fundamental question for me has always been, you got, how much do I love this? And I love transplantation. I'm so pleased that I took that, what was deemed to be rather crazy decision to come down the transplant road rather than the breast surgery road. But I figured, if I was going to make a sensible career decision, then I wouldn't have done surgery. So that ship had already sailed, really. So I think it's about, you've got to want to do it, and therefore, if you want to do it, then you have to believe you can do it. I'm not saying it's easy. And of course, again, it's about building up that support structure around you, so that you know that your patients are being looked after if you're not there, that your research is ticking over if that's what you're doing, and if you're not there, and that your children are being well looked after, and that you try not to give yourself too many deadlines. So it's about building in childcare that means that actually you don't have to leave work every day at 5:30 to get to the nursery. That actually you've got to accept that that's not realistic, and that's going to add a massive burden of stress to you, which is really going to accumulate. So it's about really thinking about the child, being realistic about the childcare you need. I think it's also having the tough discussions with your partner about the reality. And I think the sort of the idea around being a surgeon and being a parent, they're all, they're very kind of noble ideas. The reality of both of them is they're very different, and particularly being a parent, none of us are really prepared for just the sort of overwhelming tsunami that is the arrival of a small baby that needs that care. So having those discussions with your partner about what is realistic about what you're going to be able to do and how you're going to work through that, a compromise, whatever the right word is. And I think again, in all of this, what is lost so often is yourself. And I think that's the real risk. And what I always say to trainees is that you've got these different plates spinning, which is your work, your home, yourself, and just you're always going to drop a plate. You can't keep three spinning all the time, and just try and drop different ones. So sometimes you've got to step back from work because your child or children need you. Other times your children are doing okay, so you can invest a bit more in work. But the plate that gets dropped most frequently is yourself. And you've got to build in certain structures, which are, enough sleep, eating reasonably well, whatever it is your hobbies are, you've got to try and keep something ticking along so that you can keep some kind of sense of this balance that you need. And I think that's the greatest challenge, particularly there are periods when, particularly when your children are small, where you're just hanging on in there. And it's about knowing that you'll get through that. But I think sleeping whenever you can is the key bit of advice there.
Sleep and eat when you can, the old adage, isn't
Yeah,
it?
exactly. Exactly.
That's great analogy about the plates, and I'm sure that a lot of people listening to this will be really inspired by that. I wanted to touch a little bit more on less than full-time training, because am I right in thinking that is more, we're more geared up to that now, and we're more accepting of that. And what are the particular challenges for people in less than full-time training, and particularly when they're coming back from long periods of being away? What advice do you give people at that in those stages of their career?
Yeah, so I think it is challenging. I don't know. Myself and my I did a job share for a year with Tracy Gillis, who's now the medical director of NHS Lothian, and we were the first two surgical trainees to do less than full-time training. And in a sense, there was something liberating about that because nobody knew the rules, so we could sort of slightly make them up. Whereas now it's much more defined. And most of the trainees in surgery now work 80% of full time and do full time on call. That's the structure that they have. I'm not sure how much of it they have selected or that has been selected for them. So they have a day off a week, and they do the full time on call. That's the structure that which is not really less than full time training as such, but I think it's difficult. And again, I think it's about being realistic about what that means. And when you first come back, having been out on mat leave, it is difficult because you're trying to get up to speed on lots of different counts. And I think, again, it's accepting that you're not going to be as good, so technically, as you were before you went on mat leave, but you'll pick up pretty quickly. And I think most trainees that do that have a period of time that which is about, oh, what am I doing? Can I do this? Maybe I can't do surgery after all. But actually then give them a busy emergency week or something where they can really focus on work for a period of time and get back in there and they think, oh yeah, okay, this is why I'm doing it and I can do it. And I think again, understanding that that's a normal part. And I think when you're going through it, you think I'm the only person that's doubting this. And again, what we've got now is we've got last year, I've got a brilliant photo of 8 general surgical trainees out on mat leave with their baby. So they've got their own network of support now. So they can voice those kind of challenges. And it's the same for men who've become parents as well. You know, it's about just airing these challenges so that you don't think you're the only one who's struggling. But actually, it's having small children is difficult, full stop. Having small children whilst trying to juggle a career in surgery, whether you're a man or a woman, it is a difficult balance. And if you then choose to spend some time training part-time, you do feel as if you're not as good as the other people around you. And it's just about having a bit of patience. You'll get there. And when you get there, you'll forget that it ever took you quite so long.
Yeah, that's fantastic advice, and it's certainly good to see those options available now, isn't it? And much more defined in training itself. So tell us a little bit about your work-life balance, as it were, and your sort of hobbies, and how do you put up with bad days and good days and at work?
So my children are grown up. They're both in London doing their own thing, graduated off the books, so that's quite liberating. So John and I have moved out to the countryside a couple of years ago, live in a beautiful rural part of Scotland. So being outside is a big part of my life. Cycling, running. I've started, like so many people in lockdown, open water swimming and trying to keep that going over the winter when it's pretty chilly up here. So exercise is really important to me, and I think that's very good for me, both obviously physically but mentally. Running definitely is something that I use as just a de-stress tool. I increasingly think that, you know, you need to look up, you need to guard your sleep. And so yeah, I think I have a good work life balance now. And I'm as I get older, I think I'm guarding it more carefully, having good holidays, going on holidays that you really enjoy, and spending time, you know, like it's always about the people as well, isn't it? Spending time with your family, and with friends and with people who bring you that kind of positive energy. And when you're going through a tough time, know who your key people are that you can turn to. Yeah, so I think that's probably it, really.
Yeah, it helps to probably have a incredibly understanding partner in John, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say John knows all the challenges
All the
that we've
challenges.
well both been through.
Yeah, I wanted to go back and ask you about, you've got a lot of roles in national and international committees. What's your inspiration for doing that work? Because that often takes a lot more time than you think, isn't it? Why do you take on all these roles? What is your inspiration for doing that?
I think I ask myself that question quite frequently. Okay, to be an elected president of the British Transplantation Society was the greatest honour that I have enjoyed. You know, it was extraordinary. And then to work in that role, you do 2 years as vice president, 2 years as president, was again a huge honour to be able to really work in that space, and it allowed me to really think about what really matters to me, and out of that has grown the UK Organ Donation and Transplantation Research Network, which I co-direct with a patient. And for me, that has come about because I really believe in the power of collaboration and research. I think we've got to work much more smartly, and we haven't historically been very good at that in transplantation. There are a lot of silos of research which are very separate. And actually, I really believe that we've got to work together in partnership with each other and with our patients, with charities and with industry. So that's what the network is about. And that's what inspired me, you know, and that's a lot of work, but I really believe that that could make a difference. I think what I also realize, and this maybe is talking more to the some of the other national and particularly the international roles, is that I do that I am unusual. You know, there aren't many people around who women around particularly, but people around who do what I do and have that kind of portfolio of work that I've done without, I don't want to sound arrogant, but I think I can help people who are coming up, the next generation of transplanters. I think I have a contribution that is valuable to help people make the right decisions for them about their career and to follow that career dream, if you like, whilst without losing themselves entirely. So I think that's probably, without sounding too grandiose, I hope, that is what motivates me.
It's a element of giving back, isn't it, from your own experiences. It's just such a great community to be in as well. Both,
Absolutely.
both socially. I mean, even in Europe, it's still a quite a tight-knit community that we, after a few years in the field, you tend to get to know everyone, and it's nice. So we've almost spoken for an hour, which I wasn't expecting to do. I wanted to end with a question on your music taste.
Oh no, that's embarrassing.
First of all, do you play music when you operate, or are you a non-music person?
No, I play music. I play whatever playlist the theatre staff, you know, will put on, and sometimes they do it to wind me up. But yeah, so it's quite an eclectic range of music. It's whoever's iPhone is plugged into the speaker. I don't subject anyone to my taste in music because it's probably pretty
What
mediocre.
if you had one key song or one key artist that had to be played for a crucial bit of the operation, what would that be?
Okay, well I've got a couple, but I think the one that I could declare publicly is probably Snow Patrol.
Okay, good choice. Good choice.
But you know, they like playing Christmas songs when my operations have been going on for too long because they know that will speed me up. You know, so they know exactly what buttons to press. Search for the hero inside yourself, a reperfusion, you know, that kind of thing. You know, they it's
It's always great working with a team in theatre that knows you too well, isn't
yeah, exactly.
it?
Very true, very true.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I hope everyone's enjoyed that. There's so many tips that Lorna's given us. It's so fantastic to talk to a leader in the field who's been there, done that, got the t-shirt. Really grateful for for the time you've given us, and thank you very much.
Pleasure. I enjoyed it. Thank you very much, Dylan, for your great questions.
Hope they weren't too taxing. So th thanks everyone. Please go back and look at the other podcasts that we put on. This podcast is available on Spotify for you to listen on your drive for training to work, or maybe where you're operating. And we've got two or three more podcasts lined up before Christmas that will be coming out soon. So I hope you're enjoying these podcasts. Any feedback would be much appreciated. And we thank Lorna again, and look forward to seeing you at the with the next podcast. Take care, everyone. Bye.
Thanks, Dylan. Bye.